Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Due to the graphic nature of this murder case, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
Hey, George.
Hey, Mary. Gee, that's some dress.
Thanks. I'm heading down to the parade.
Me too. Say, how about we go together?
Aw, sorry, George. I don't think so. I've got to stop at the pencil factory to pick up my paycheck first.
Oh, okay.
But I can meet you down there, and then after the parade, maybe we can catch a movie.
Hey, that'd be swell.
This is my stop. Let's meet at the drugstore down on Peachtree. See you, George.
See you, Mary.
On Saturday, April 26th, 1913, 13-year-old Mary Fagan rode the English Avenue trolley into downtown Atlanta, Georgia. The city was abuzz with excitement for the Confederate Memorial Day parade.
Mary walked in the opposite direction of the crowds, heading instead towards the National Pencil Company, where she worked during the week. The massive four-story granite building took up a full city block and towered over the surrounding mills.
Mary pulled open the heavy metal front doors and went inside. She would remain there until dawn the next day, when the city undertaker would emerge through the same archway, carrying her lifeless corpse. This is Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. I'm your host, Carter Roy.
And I'm your host, Wendy McKenzie. This is our first episode on Little Mary Fagan, a 13-year-old child laborer who was brutally murdered at her factory in 1913.
You can listen to previous episodes of Unsolved Murders, as well as all of Parcast's other shows on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. A new episode comes out every Tuesday. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast, and on Twitter at Parcast Network.
Some listeners have been asking how they can help support the show. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to do that is to leave us a 5-star review.
Mary Fagan was born in Alabama in 1899. Her father, William Joshua Fagan, had died of measles only a few months earlier, leaving the family in dire financial straits. Shortly after Mary's birth, her mother moved the family to Marietta, Georgia, a rural area about 20 miles northwest of Atlanta.
As a young girl, Mary was known to be precocious and independent. When she was only 10 years old, she quit school and went to work full-time to help support her family.
In 1912, Mary's mother remarried to Jonathan Coleman, who worked at the Atlanta Municipal Sanitation Department. The family moved into the city, taking a dingy apartment in the lower-class neighborhood of Bellwood.
It was a drastic change from the quiet streets of Marietta, but across the state, thousands of families were undergoing similar transitions.
Over the previous decade, fluctuating cotton prices had led to a shift away from the agrarian culture that had dominated life in the South. Between 1900 and 1910, Atlanta nearly doubled in size as former tenant farmers moved into the city and took jobs in factories and mills.
But Mary was still a country girl at heart. While she loved going to the movies with her new friends in the city, she dreamed of saving up enough money to move west and live with her cousins.
Mary took a job at the National Pencil Company, where she spent 55 hours a week working a machine that fitted erasers into the pencil's metal ends.
The week before April 26, 1913, Mary found herself with an unusual amount of free time on her hands. A delayed metal shipment caused the factory to run out of pencil ends early in the week. As a result, Mary was put on temporary leave after completing only two shifts. Her paycheck for the week was for a mere $1.20.
Despite the small sum, Mary devoted a few hours of her Saturday to picking up the check. Upon arriving at the factory, she climbed the stairs to the second floor office of Superintendent Leo Frank.
Come in.
Hello, Mr. Frank. I'm here for my paycheck.
Employee number?
186.
Here it is.
Thank you. Did the new metal shipment come in yet? Mama keeps bugging me about how I need to get back to work.
No, it hasn't arrived yet.
All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your Saturday, Mr. Frank.
What happened next remains a mystery, but Leo Frank would forever remain the last known person to have seen Mary Fagan alive.
Around 3:30 a.m. the next morning, Atlanta police received a call from the night watchman of the National Pencil Company. The night watchman, a former slave in his 50s named Newt Lee, had discovered a body in the factory basement.
Sergeants R.J. Brown, L. Dobbs, and call officer W. Anderson hopped into a car and tore across the dark Atlanta streets.
Hey, over here!
Atlanta police, are you the night watchman who found the girl?
That's right. I'm the one who called. This way.
Newt led the officers inside the factory. At the back of the lobby, he pointed them to a narrow scuttle hole in the floor.
She's down there.
There's got to be another way down. What about the elevator?
Electricity's turned off on Sunday. Superintendent's got the key, but he didn't pick up his telephone.
Very well. Watch your head, boys.
The officers' flashlights scanned the cavernous factory basement, passing over piles of wood shavings, ash, and rubbish.
Newt Lee led the way with a grimy lantern, pointing ahead to what he had discovered.
I came down around 3 o'clock to use the toilet. When I first saw it, I didn't think it was real. Thought it must be some devilish boys playing a prank on me.
Can't believe you could see anything down here.
Look out, you'll step on her.
Where? Oh!
They found the body at the back of the basement, face down in a shallow pile of debris. She was covered from head to toe in ash and soot, apparently having been dragged across the filthy basement floor.
She was so blackened, in fact, that the officers could not identify her race until they lowered her stocking to reveal a milky white thigh.
Turning the body over only revealed more horrors. The girl's face was badly bruised and scratched. One eye was swollen nearly shut. A jagged gash ran along the left side of her skull.
A cord had been tied around her throat, and judging by the deep purple welt, used to throttle the life from her.
Her dress had been hitched up around her waist, her garters unfastened, her underwear was torn and bloody.
Rigor mortis was already setting in, suggesting that she had been dead for several hours.
The strangest discovery, however, was found beneath the body.
What's that you found there, Anderson?
It's a note. Well, two notes. But it doesn't make any sense. It's like she wrote them while she was being killed.
The first note they recovered was in broken English. The language used was much more insensitive than we are presenting here, but it read as a type of accusation. It began, quote, "He said he would love me and lay down. Play like the night witch did it. But that long, tall, black man did boy hisself."
Night witch? What's that?
Maybe night watchman?
That's me.
Is that a confession, Mr. Lee?
No, sir. Someone's trying to put this off on me.
What does the other note say?
The second note was just as incomprehensible as the first. It read, quote, "That black man higher down here did this. I went to make water and he pushed me down that hole. A long, tall black man, that's who it was. Long, slim, tall. I write while play with me."
I'd reckon Mr. Newt Lee here is pretty tall and slim, wouldn't you?
I didn't do this.
Maybe you did, maybe you didn't, Mr. Lee. Either way, I think there's a lot you're not telling us.
Overall, the notes were altogether incoherent, but the police still decided to act upon their content.
The officers handcuffed Newt Lee and led him away, hopeful that they had landed themselves an open and shut case. There remained, however, the mystery of the murdered girl's identity.
Fortunately, the man who had driven the officers to the scene had a 16-year-old sister-in-law who worked at the pencil factory, and he raced off at once to collect her.
Miss Hicks, do you recognize this girl?
I'm afraid so. That's Mary Fagan. She works on my floor. The poor thing.
With their victim now identified, the officer's next task was to contact the factory's superintendent. This proved more difficult than they had anticipated.
Newt Lee had already tried to reach his boss once, but Leo Frank had not answered his phone. This wasn't particularly surprising, considering that the call would have been made around 3:30 in the morning.
But when the police called the superintendent later that same morning, they got the same result. Leo Frank's phone rang for 10 minutes before they gave up.
By this point, Detective John Black had been roused and assigned to the case. Like his colleagues, Detective Black was confident that the culprit behind Mary Fagan's murder was already in handcuffs. Nevertheless, the fact that Leo Frank had twice neglected to answer his phone did not sit well with him.
So it was with an already primed sense of suspicion that Detective Black made his way across town to Leo Frank's two-story home in the heart of Atlanta's German-Jewish district.
Hello?
Hello, ma'am. Does Leo Frank live here?
My husband? He's just getting dressed. Oh, here he is.
The half-dressed man hurrying down the stairs was slight and slender, with sharp, angular features and round glasses that only served to accentuate his large eyes.
A Cornell graduate from Brooklyn, Leo Frank was 29 years old and had only lived in Georgia for 5 years. Yet, he was already considered a notable rising businessman.
His wife, Lucille, was the granddaughter of a well-known Atlantan rabbi, and the marriage had brought him a fair bit of clout in the city's Jewish community.
He was bookish, dedicated to his job, and not at all prepared for the day that awaited him.
Leo Frank, superintendent of the National Pencil Company?
Yes, sir. What seems to be the trouble?
I'm Detective John Black of the Atlanta Police Department. I want you to come down to the factory right away.
Has there been a fire? Did the night watchman report anything to you? I dreamt I heard the phone ring around 4 o'clock.
Would you like some coffee, Detective?
Yes, coffee. I'll take one, Lucille.
Mr. Frank, I think you'd better finish getting dressed and let us get on our way.
Detective Black's immediate impression of Leo Frank was that he seemed unusually agitated. The superintendent rambled and fidgeted nonstop throughout the following car ride.
I wish you would have waited a few more minutes, Detective. I'm really no good without my morning coffee.
Do you know a Mary Fagan, Mr. Frank?
No, I don't know anyone by that name. Mary Fagan, you said.
Didn't a little girl with long hair come to your office yesterday for her money?
Oh, yes, I do remember that now. But I didn't know her name was Mary Fagan. A lot of girls work at the factory.
Well, this little girl was murdered in your basement last night.
Oh. Well, like I said, we have a lot of employees. I didn't know her.
Their first stop was the mortuary. Leo Frank hovered in the doorway while the undertaker switched on the electric lamp and peeled back the sheet that covered the body.
The detectives watched the superintendent's reaction carefully, noting how he turned away from the sight of the cinder-covered corpse.
Mr. Frank, we need you to look.
Yes, I recognize her. I didn't know her name, but I know she came in yesterday for her money.
Detective Black nodded for the undertaker to lower the sheet. Out of the corner of his eye, he watched Leo Frank continue to fidget nervously in the doorway. The detective was not sure what to make of the odd, skinny superintendent, but the day was just beginning.
We'll learn more about what happened to Mary at the factory after this.
And now, back to the story.
By the time Leo Frank and Detective Black left the mortuary early on the morning of April 27, 1913, news that a girl had been murdered in the basement of the National Pencil Factory was spreading across Atlanta like wildfire.
A crowd of curious onlookers had already formed outside the doors of the National Pencil Company when Detective Black and Leo Frank arrived at 7:45 a.m. They headed straight to the superintendent's office, where Newt Lee was still waiting in handcuffs.
Leo Frank opened the safe behind his desk and removed the ledger he used to track paycheck distribution.
Yes, here it is. Mary Fagan definitely worked here. She came in yesterday to collect her pay, just after 12 o'clock and left right afterwards. I'm afraid I don't remember which way she went as she left.
That's fine, Mr. Frank. Do you have any records of Newt Lee's activities last night?
If he made his required rounds, he should have punched in every half hour. Here's the card. Yes, he reported in at 6 p.m. and finished at 3 a.m. Everything seems to be in order here.
Their next stop was the factory basement. Leo Frank turned on the electricity so that they could access it via the building's elevator instead of the scuttle hole they had been using all morning.
The elevator groaned to life, but when Leo Frank tried to pull the mechanism to start it moving, it refused to budge.
Sometimes it gets stuck like this. Just takes a little muscle, giving me a little bit more trouble than usual.
Detective Black wasn't sure whether Frank was too weak or too nervous to operate the lift, but he soon grew tired of watching the superintendent strain against the machinery.
Allow me.
Oh, my goodness.
What the hell is that smell?
As the elevator touched down, a noxious, putrid odor wafted through the car. It took a moment for the investigators to understand the source.
Someone had left a mound of fresh human excrement in the elevator shaft. The detectives had missed it on their initial search of the basement, but when the elevator mashed it after descending, it released the noxious odor.
This second search of the basement revealed little new evidence. Afterwards, Leo Frank was then taken to the police station to review the letters that had been found beneath Mary Fagan's body.
The detectives hoped that Leo Frank might be able to provide some insight into the meaning of the cryptic notes. But when they got to the station, the notes were gone.
They had been borrowed temporarily by a reporter from the Atlanta Journal, which would reprint them in the next day's paper.
The fact that such an important piece of evidence was now in the hands of civilians should have been alarming to the officers, especially since the notes had not yet been checked for fingerprints, but they took the news in stride.
They thanked Leo Frank, who then returned home to fill Lucille in on his eventful day.
By the morning of Monday, April 29th, the murder was all anyone in Atlanta was talking about.
The Atlanta Georgian newspaper had been allowed access to the mortuary to photograph Mary Fagan's corpse. They plastered their front page with a picture of the deceased girl's face cropped onto the body of a living girl who appeared to be mid-curtsy.
This inflammatory image and the lurid details of the condition in which Mary had been found horrified the city's residents and seemed to confirm the worst fears of Atlantan parents.
Poverty had forced them to send their children to work in dangerous factories under the watch of untrustworthy foremen. The vile crime that had been committed against Mary Fagan could not go unpunished, lest it be allowed to happen again.
The public's sense of anger was perhaps best captured by Mary Fagan's grandfather, who was quoted in the Georgian with what was likely a fair bit of journalistic embellishment.
I hope the murderer will be dealt with as he dealt with that innocent child. I hope his heart is torn with remorse in the measure that his victim suffered pain and shame, that he suffers as we who love the child are suffering. No punishment is too great for the brute who foully murdered the sweetest and purest thing on earth, a young girl. Hanging cannot atone for the crime he has committed.
As the public's concern with the case grew, new evidence began to appear.
On that same morning, the 29th, hundreds of laborers reported to the National Pencil Company for work. Almost immediately, their arrival brought fresh discoveries.
Well, shortly after opening, an 18-year-old machinist discovered a red stain on the floor of the metal department, not far from Mary Fagan's workstation. Then he found several strands of auburn hair in one of the machines, which he swore had not been there on Friday.
Police Chief James Beavers collected the evidence and, through a rudimentary test, determined that the stain was, in fact, blood.
Immediately, the police began operating under the theory that Mary had been attacked in the second-floor metal department before being taken to the basement. It did not escape them that this would have placed her initial attack relatively close to Leo Frank's office.
Around midday, Leo Frank was summoned to the police station once again. Detective Black led him up to the second-floor office of Newport Lanford, the chief of detectives.
Mr. Frank, we've spent a good deal of time speaking with your night watchman, Newt Lee. We have a few questions about his testimony that we hoped you could clear up for us.
Absolutely. I want to help the investigation any way I can.
Newt's been telling us that you were acting a bit funny when he arrived for work on Sunday.
Funny?
You know, squirrely. Newt also says that when he arrived, you sent him away from the factory for several hours.
That's because he arrived several hours early for his shift. I thought he'd want to enjoy the parade.
He also says that you called him later on that evening and asked if everything was all right at the factory. He says that you've never done that before. What's that, Mr. Frank?
Newt Lee is a fairly new employee. The other watchman can confirm that it's a standard procedure for me to call in the evenings to check in.
The chief of detectives and the superintendent had only been alone a few seconds before they were interrupted.
I'm going into that room. That man is my client.
Hello, boys. What seems to be the trouble?
Bald, boisterous, and built like a linebacker, Luther Rosser was a legendary bulldog of an attorney who catered to Atlantan elites.
He had been contacted that morning by Sig Montag, the majority shareholder of the National Pencil Corporation. Mr. Montag had evidently realized that his superintendent was quickly becoming a target of the investigation.
With Rosser present, Chief Lanford was forced to reconsider his interrogation approach. Leo Frank took the opportunity to offer up a new piece of information.
There was something I wanted to say. Something that seems much more important than all these questions you're asking me.
What's that, Mr. Frank?
When I looked at Newt Lee's punch card on Sunday, I thought everything was in order, but I only had a moment to look. This morning, I was reviewing it, and I discovered he actually missed several check-ins.
Is that right?
Yes, you can make of that what you will, but I'm afraid it appears that my night watchman's activities are unaccounted for during a large stretch of Saturday night. He might have had time to go home, or who knows what.
Leo Frank's suggestion that Newt Lee might have had time to perpetrate the crime was clear enough, but the police had an altogether different reaction to the news. To them, Leo Frank's late discovery of the punch card error seemed purposefully intended to point the finger at the night watchman.
When they tried to press him on that point, Luther Rosser objected.
Do you mind if I ask what inspired you to review the time cards again, Mr. Frank?
This is ridiculous. You're talking to my client like you think he's done something wrong. If he'd done anything to that little girl, don't you think he'd have some scratches on him or something?
That's right. I don't have any scratches. I can show you.
Leo Frank immediately stripped down to his undergarments and proudly displayed that he did not, in fact, have any scratches or marks on his person.
Then, determined to be thorough, he invited the detectives back to his home, where he painstakingly laid out his dirty laundry to prove that there was not a speck of blood or ash on any garment of clothing.
Evidently, Leo Frank did not think his display had been successful in convincing the investigators. As soon as the police left, he contacted the Pinkerton Detective Agency's Atlanta offices.
Only a few hours later, Leo Frank sat down with the office's second-in-command, Detective Harry Scott.
Thanks for meeting with me, Detective.
What seems to be the trouble, Mr. Frank?
Well, Detective John Black seems to suspect me of a crime.
For well over an hour, Leo Frank walked the Pinkerton detective through his interactions with the police. He listed other employees he thought the police should be looking at, especially young men who he thought had been overly familiar with Mary, and rambled through rumors he had heard at the factory that day.
And Mr. Darley told me that Mrs. White told him that she saw a black fellow in dark blue clothing loitering by the elevator shaft around 12 o'clock noon on Saturday.
After Leo Frank had told the detective everything that he could think of, they discussed the agency's price and Scott agreed to take the case. Leo Frank returned home for the evening.
On Tuesday, April 29th, Mary Fagan was buried in Marietta, the small city outside of Atlanta where she had grown up.
Her family was so inconsolable that volunteers had to be chosen to serve as pallbearers. Mary's mother, Fanny Fagan Coleman, reportedly fell to her knees before the casket, sobbing.
Goodbye, Mary. Goodbye. It's too big a hole to put you in. It's so big. And you were so little.
The sermon by Reverend Linkous sought at once to capture the family's grief and the public's fury. It also served as an indictment against the Atlanta police, who had so far failed to identify the culprit.
We pray that this wretch, this devil, be caught and punished according to the man-made, God-sanctioned laws of Georgia.
Almost at the same moment that Mary Fagan was being lowered into the ground, Detective John Black was letting himself into Newt Lee's tiny apartment.
Detective Black's search of the apartment unveiled an astonishingly suspicious clue, a linen shirt positively soaked through with blood.
At face value, the shirt seemed to incriminate Newt Lee. But as Detective Black examined it, he became convinced that it had been planted there to draw attention to the night watchman. Despite being filthy with blood, the shirt seemed almost to be freshly pressed, as if no one had worn it. The red stains were so thick that the detective couldn't help but wonder if they had been intentionally applied.
By this point, all of Detective Black's suspicions had coalesced into a firm theory. He believed he knew exactly who had killed little Mary Fagan.
At 11:30 a.m. on Tuesday, April 29th, Leo Frank was at work at the pencil factory when Detective Black and several other officers arrived. To Leo Frank's astonishment, they were accompanied by Harry Scott, the Pinkerton detective who he had met with the day before.
Hello, detectives. More questions? Mr. Scott, what are you doing here?
Harry's an old friend of mine, Mr. Frank. We've been discussing our theories on the case, and I think we're both in agreement.
Friends? That's surprising.
We'd like you to come with us to the station.
Can't I answer your questions here? I have a lot of work to do.
I'm afraid that's not going to work, Leo. We're placing you under arrest.
Within minutes, word spread throughout the factory that Leo Frank was being taken into custody. Dozens of young laborers abandoned their machinery and raced to the lobby to watch their boss be escorted from the building.
They spilled out onto the streets, necks craning for a view as Leo Frank was ushered into the waiting police car. He glanced back at them, wide, frightened eyes reflecting their own stunned expressions. Then the door slammed shut. The engine revved, and the police car sped away down the streets of Atlanta.
Coming up, Leo Frank's long battle for freedom begins.
Now, back to the story.
Atlanta police had become increasingly suspicious of Leo Frank. Ever since Mary Fagan was discovered in the basement of the National Pencil Factory on the morning of April 27th, 1913.
The 13-year-old factory worker was buried in Marietta on April 29th. Only a few hours later, Leo Frank was arrested. He arrived at the Atlanta Police Department shortly before noon.
Did you do it, Mr. Frank? Did you kill little Mary Fagan?
I am not guilty. Such an atrocious crime has never entered my mind. I am a man of good character and I have a wife. I am a home-loving and God-fearing man.
Come on, Leo. Let's go.
Detectives John Black and Harry Scott hurried Leo Frank past an army of reporters clamoring outside the police station. They were soon joined by Luther Rosser, now officially stepping in as Leo Frank's attorney.
The detectives presented Leo Frank with a corner of the shirt that they had found at Newt Lee's apartment.
Do you recognize this fabric?
You don't have to answer that.
That's all right. I want to be helpful. I haven't seen anything like this before.
While the interrogation started smoothly, Leo became increasingly frustrated as Pinkerton Detective Harry Scott took the reins.
You're sure you don't own any shirt like this?
I said I don't recognize it. And you're acting mighty funny, Mr. Scott. I hired you, if you remember. Why should you ask me such questions?
I was put on this case by my superiors. They were employed to catch the murderer. That was what I was instructed to do. If you are the murderer, then it's my duty to convict you.
After hours of questioning, Leo Frank was taken to a private room down the hall from Landford's office, while an armed guard kept watch outside.
Around midnight, Leo lay down in the narrow cot that had been provided for him and tried to fall asleep. He had barely shut his eyes when Detectives Black and Scott returned.
What now, detectives? Am I being released?
We had an idea, Mr. Frank. We've been questioning Newt Lee for several days now, and he hasn't changed his story one bit. Now, you're his boss. He respects you. We can't get much more out of him, but maybe you can.
I'll try my best.
Leo Frank was led down to the cell where Newt Lee was being kept. The detectives handcuffed both the suspects to their chairs and then stepped out of the room. They hovered by the door, listening.
Now, Newt, you are here and I am here, and you'd better open up and tell them everything you know. And tell the truth, the full truth, because if not, you're going to get us both into a lot of trouble.
Before God, Mr. Frank, I am telling the truth. I've told them all I know.
No matter how much Leo Frank pressed Newt Lee, the night watchman would not change his story. But the detectives listening from outside were far more interested in the superintendent.
They were now convinced that Leo Frank had murdered Mary Fagan. But in order to bring charges, they would need to convince a coroner's jury.
Well, the inquest began on Wednesday afternoon. Leo Frank and Newt Lee were both taken to a boardroom on the third floor, where they recounted the events of Saturday, April 26th, to a jury panel and Paul Danahue, the coroner who would manage the proceedings.
Late in the afternoon, a 15-year-old newsboy named George Epps was called in to speak. He informed the room that he had ridden the trolley with Mary Fagan on Saturday.
We made a date to watch the parade, and then we were going to see a picture after. But first, Mary had to stop at the pencil factory. She said she was going to pick up her paycheck from her boss.
You mean from the superintendent?
Yes, sir.
And did she have anything else to say about Mr. Leo Frank?
She had already told me about him plenty. She was real frightened of him.
Why would she be frightened of Mr. Frank?
Mary didn't like the way he looked at her. She said he'd wink at her and look at her real hard and then smile.
Did she say this occurred frequently?
Oh, yeah. She said he was always paying her attention, trying to flirt with her and all. Sometimes when she'd leave, he'd rush out of the factory and try to talk to her. She always wanted me to come down to the factory when she got off and to escort her home. I wish I'd done so Saturday. I woulda, but I still had to sell some papers before our date.
The effect George Epps' testimony had on the coroner's jury was undeniable. Luther Rosser knew that the case against his client had profoundly changed.
Up till now, the police's case against Leo Frank had been built largely on circumstantial evidence and hinged around what they saw as unusually nervous behavior. From George's testimony onward, the police would seek to malign his character.
When Epps had given his testimony, Coroner Danahue called a pause to the proceedings. Leo Frank was led back to his room on the second floor of the police station, well aware that at that moment, newspapers were rushing to print George Epps's claims.
By the next morning, reporters were hounding Leo Frank's friends and relatives for more stories of impropriety. But the case was far from over.
At 2 o'clock on Thursday, May 1st, the day after George Epps gave his inflammatory testimony to the coroner's jury, a day watchman at the National Pencil Company was making his rounds when he made a surprising discovery.
Hey, Jim.
Oh, you startled me.
What's that you got in your hand?
Nothing.
That thing you just dropped. Let me see.
The watchman stumbled upon the factory sweeper, a man named Jim Conley, vigorously attempting to wash dark red stains from a blue shirt.
Conley immediately tried to hide what he was doing, but the watchman's suspicions were piqued. He contacted the police, and Conley was taken into custody.
Jim Conley was familiar enough to the Atlanta police, having been arrested dozens of times before on charges of public intoxication and one case of attempted armed robbery.
Despite his history, the detectives quickly determined that it was unlikely that he had anything to do with Mary Fagan's murder. Well, for one thing, Conley claimed to be illiterate, which meant that he could not have written the notes found beneath the girl's corpse. And more importantly, they were now adamant that Leo Frank was the true culprit. Conley was seen as an inconvenient complication in a case that was already becoming too complicated.
The factory sweeper was placed in a cell and momentarily forgotten, until word of his arrest made its way to Leo Frank.
Wait a minute. You're telling me they found him at the factory washing blood out of a blue shirt?
They're not sure that it's blood. I've been told it could be rust.
But don't you see? Mrs. White saw a black man in blue clothing waiting by the elevator shaft on Saturday, right around the time the girl was killed.
You told the police this?
I told Detective Scott. I have no idea whether he told anyone else.
I'll look into it. In any case, the police don't think Conley could be the killer, on account of him being illiterate.
Conley's not illiterate. He takes inventory for me all the time. He writes it down on a pad of paper, signs it, and everything. Where are you going?
To get Detective Black. He needs to hear this.
The revelation that Conley could read and write immediately made him suspect number one in the detective's investigation.
Mrs. White, the woman Leo Frank claimed had seen the real murderer, was summoned to the precinct to view a lineup of Jim Conley and 12 other men. The results were inconclusive, however, because Mrs. White picked another man first and Conley second.
Over the next few weeks, Detective Black and Detective Scott hammered Jim Conley for information. Slowly, his story started to change.
We know you've been lying to us, Jim. We've got the Deadwood on you. Time to come clean.
I've told you everything I know. Honest.
You know what perjury is, don't you, Jim?
No, sir.
Swearing a lie.
But I'm not lying.
You will, if you swear you can't write.
The detective unfolded a sheet of paper and placed it before Jim Conley. The suspect stared down at his own signature for a long moment before looking back up.
Well, I'm a liar.
You can write?
Yes, boss, I can. I was scared.
Because you wrote those murder notes we found under that little girl.
I didn't! I swear before God I didn't write those!
Show me how well you can write, Jim. Try this sentence. That long, tall, black man did this.
You want me to write that?
I sure do, Jim.
The results were undeniable. When the detectives compared Jim Conley's writing with the murder notes, they found the same repeated misspellings and errors.
For several hours, the detectives subjected Jim Conley to intense questioning and endless threats. Eventually, he was taken back to his solitary cell to mull over what had transpired.
It took 1 week in the basement of the police station for Jim Conley to break. After stating that he was ready to talk, he was taken to Detective Lanford's office on the second floor. There, the chief of detectives, along with Detective Black, Detective Scott, and several other investigators, waited patiently for the factory sweeper to speak.
Okay, Jim. Tell them what you told me.
I did it, boss. I wrote those letters.
Jim Conley, are you confessing to the murder of Mary Fagan?
No, sir. I wrote those letters, but I didn't kill no little girl.
Jim Conley told the investigators a mystifying story that would change countless times over the coming days, becoming even more peculiar and mystifying. It would capture headlines and enthrall the people of Atlanta for weeks to come.
It would have a major role to play in the upcoming trial and its bloody aftermath.
Thanks again for tuning in to Unsolved Murders. We'll be back next Tuesday with part two of the murder of Mary Fagan.
You can find Unsolved Murders and all of Parcast's shows on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A new episode comes out every Tuesday.
You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and on Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is by leaving a 5-star review online. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, if we live till next time.
Unsolved Murders True Crime Stories is a Spotify original from Parcast. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Trent Williamson, Carly Madden, Paul Mahler, Maggie Admire, and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Unsolved Murders was written by Andrew Kelleher. The amazing cast of voice actors includes Mike Capozzi, Kai Jordan, Sky King, Kathleen Nielsen, Steve Pinto, Manib Rahman, and Julian Smith. Unsolved Murders stars Wendy McKenzie and Carter Roy.